I would say there's two questions motivating this learning. What do we do if we're not really feeling it when it comes to tefillah, relationship with God? Does tefillah have any power even if we were standing more towards this side of the room? On, I would say, two particular questions that come up in the exercise. Have you felt moved by a tefillah experience? Do you feel God in your life? I would say, like, what happens if maybe often or every now and then it's more in the, like, not feeling it side? Is there any power to tefillah nonetheless? So that's kind of part one. And part two of the question is, does it all depend on me? Does this question about feeling moved by tefillah, feeling God's presence, does that really rest on my own internal kind of fortitude in forging a relationship with God and having a meaningful prayer life and doing theological reflection? Like, is this just about my own kind of chizik, my own emunah? Am I my own kind of isolated being in trying to find and sustain the power of this? This is like a tiny little piece from Masachet Brachot, Daf Hei Amud Bet, 5b. We have what is presented as a breita, some early teaching. Abba Binyamin Omer, Shneim Shenichnesu Lihitpalel, Bekadam Echad Mehem Lihitpalel, Velo Himtin Et Chavero, Biyatza, Torfin Lo Tfilata Befanav. So two people go somewhere, they pray, one of them finishes early, doesn't wait for their fellow, walks out, their prayer gets torn up in their face. And we have our proof text from the book of Job. So the first question was like, what's so bad? What's so bad about what this person did? They finished their Amidah a little bit more quickly. So they go back about their life and their day. Why is this so terrible that their prayers should get? Yes.
My Chavrutah Miriam taught me that when you're just learning to daven, and I've had this experience too, when you're just learning to daven, you're very slow, and you're in the minyan, and everyone else is going, and I don't know, especially Psuke, I imagine in the Amida as well, they finish, and maybe you've got like two or three lines in, and this just keeps happening and happening, and it's not a good feeling. As a beginner, it's very, you know, it can be disorienting, maybe a little alienating. And that really is something that is worth being upset over, to not wait for someone who's slower.
Okay, great. So maybe this affects the actual experience of the other person who's still in tefillah. It's disorienting to the person who's still davening, or maybe disheartening.
August and I were talking about, we kind of like, we're trying to figure out what this meant from the proof text. And so we were looking at like what is torn in both instances. And in the sugya, what's torn is the prayer. And in the proof text, what's torn is like the like self. And we were imagining the, like, what would it mean for like the prayer to be sort of analogous to the self? And thinking about it as like, if the prayer is sort of like constituting the community, that is being, by leaving in the sort of middle of an ongoing prayer like time, you're kind of tearing that community apart. And I think, like August said, like, imagine if you're walking in with somebody, as in the story, and then like they're gone when you finish davening, like the davening is the thing that broke that like relationship and that conversation apart, instead of like bringing it sort of continuing into the future. And so that was what we were focused on, and like seeing that breaking as like sort of analogous, that leaving as like analogous to an exile.
Okay, so sort of disrupting, unraveling the fabric of that prayer community.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
On a similar note, we were talking about how it seems like these two people, or whatever the situation you can extrapolate, are like agreeing to have some sort of prayer. Like we're entering, right, Nifnasu, to have this prayer experience in some form, and then one person like detracts from that by leaving early. Like, make an analogy, like, oh, we know that Dvarakara is going to be at this point in the service, right? And then if someone changes that, the destabilizing force on like the large, like the prayer experience was agreed to in some form, and then the one person is like backing out of that, which just seems to be like the issue. Not like the prayer itself, but like the whole, the surrounding, yes.
Okay, great. Meaning like, it seems like part of the premise here is they went in together. There's some agreement about a shared thing, a shared experience they're going to have. Maybe if they just, if you just happen to be found in a space and someone else happens to come in and is davening, then maybe if you left early, it wouldn't be such a big deal. But it's sort of the premise is that you're trying to create something together in this space. Okay. Thank you. Yes.
I'm Jeremy, and I'm going to tell you that what my Rotatal gave the image, which is that you're like two people alone in Japan. You go to Abad, and one person leaves halfway through. Then you're leaving the other person alone in the community they don't know. And that could be one of the problems.
Okay, yes, this is very interesting. Thank you for that super helpful and concrete example. What if the space that they're going to pray in is dangerous? Right, or somehow leaving somebody alone in that space is actually... There's something about that context or environment that may be leaving that person as somewhat vulnerable. But you're sort of talking about a case where someone's socially vulnerable. You can also imagine in this Perek of Talmud, we talk about spaces that are physically vulnerable and possibly just being alone in the times of the Talmud in, you know, not fully urban environments where there's lots of people around all the time. It could actually be that just leaving somebody by themselves leaves them vulnerable. It's not spiritual vulnerability, it's like actual vulnerability.
I think kind of building off of that, I think what's really special about davening in minyan or in a group is that it's a very personally vulnerable experience, but it's almost easier to do because you know other people are doing it with you. And I think like this act of leaving someone while they're in this like possibly vulnerable and like spiritual state feels like even more of a like a almost like a diss, like, well, we were doing this, like we were having this shared experience together, and it's possible that it's physically dangerous, but even if it isn't, like even if it's fine to leave and everyone's going to be okay physically, I think it's kind of breaking that shared trust like we were mentioning before, and the like just vulnerability that each person has when they are davening.
Okay, thank you. Meaning like the state of davening itself, a person's kind of exposing themselves, maybe they're kind of losing their sense of self-consciousness to some extent to just kind of leave somebody alone in that way could be problematic.
If you were to leave your fellow while they were in the middle of the Amidah, you could look on it as you're both abandoning them in their moment of petition before God, and it could also be like a repudiation of God. I think because the verse in Eov, in context anyways, one of Eov's friends charging him with repudiating God in a way, saying, do you think the order of the world will change for you just because you're upset at your faith? So it could be both repudiation of God and repudiation or an abandonment of your fellow in this, I think someone else said, in a vulnerable state, because you are in the posture of a servant before the king. I don't know. I think I've also had the experience of leaving someone, of being the one who left, and it felt terrible. And I couldn't really articulate why, but I felt like I was abandoning them in a vulnerable moment.
Okay, thank you. We're going to look at that proof text more carefully in just a minute, but thank you for bringing it more to the fore. Yes.
I was thinking that it's more like the second guy is like the one who's leaving is just like totally unaware that him and the first guy are on the same team. And he thinks that if he leaves, like, oh, he's going to go back to his life and he's going to get home a few minutes faster. Like he's really going somewhere. But it's in his best interest to support the first guy because they're what each one is doing is spiritually impacting the other. And so he's abandoning the team and he doesn't realize really that his role at that time is to be buoying up this first guy and giving him strength.
Okay, very powerful image, right? This is like we're getting to somehow what I want this little passage in the Talmud to do. It's like giving us a window into an interpersonal dimension of what seems to otherwise be tfilat yachid, individual prayer. But it's not actually clear that there's a minyan here. It seems like there's probably not a whole minyan, or this wouldn't be such a big problem, and it would have said like 10 people go into to daven together instead of two. So even in what you might have thought was a very kind of personal, individual experience of tefillah, this is pointing to some kind of interpersonal dimension, responsibility there. And I want to look at this proof text from Eov a little bit more closely, though I won't pretend to fully understand it. Right, the way that Rashi reads this, which I didn't give you, so I don't expect you to know, though some of you kind of anticipated, which is awesome. How do you make this proof text work at all? It doesn't mention tefillah. It doesn't mention prayer at all. Toref nafsho be'apo, right? Something about their own self being torn up. And so, yes, Rashi makes the move that this chavruta made, which is like, well, the only way this works is that we seem to be making some sort of equation between tefillah and nefesh, right? That actually your prayer is the same as yourself. Otherwise, this proof text has no relevance whatsoever. So that's like the first thing that we have to do for this proof text to work. And now we could spend the next hour just talking about that. What does it mean that your tefillah is yourself? Right? Rashi brings a pasuk that we're going to see later in the week from the tefillah of Chana. Va'ashpoch et nafshi lifnei Hashem. I poured out my soul to God. That tefillah is essentially us pouring ourselves out, making ourselves vulnerable in a way. It might be that through our tefillah, we like sustain ourselves, and so somehow they're like synonyms. Our prayers are ourselves. Okay, so that's one thing that you have to do. But then, right, how do we understand this next part of that verse in Eov? Halama'ancha te'azev aretz. Will the land be abandoned for your sake? Is what you have in the translation, right? And Rashi here, well, I'm trying, like, what did you do with that part, right? You were sort of, I think, trying to explain what that might mean. Who's doing the abandoning as we try to parse out this verse? God?
Well, we were reading the passage from Job and trying to remember the greater context where Job's friends are kind of trying to provide some kind of comfort or just challenge to his despair and experience of suffering, which causes him to have this kind of crisis. We were struggling to reconcile this with how it connects to the story, because we thought in the context of Job, the friend is kind of telling him, even though you're feeling all this anger, we still don't think this will affect the order of the world or the fact that God is present in the world.
Okay, just because you're so upset, you think God leaves the world. So now, our example here, we're not talking about somebody being upset, but it seems like what you think just because of your own internal process that affects God being there or not. How does this all work in this context of leaving when you're done your prayer? You finish your prayer and you think that because you finished your own tefillah, God's presence is also done here? Even though somebody else here is still engaged in tefillah. So if you were kind of clued into somebody besides yourself, you would realize, oh, must be that the Shekhinah is still here. Somebody else is davening here. That seems to be the way Rashi understands it. It's your havamina. It's what you seem to be thinking, that God's presence stays or leaves based on your own internal state of praying or being done with your own prayer. Like, you are not marionetting God in that way, right? God is sort of larger than your own need for an audience with God. Okay, we'll get back to that in a second. I saw a hand here.
It feels a lot like cautioning against self-importance or centering yourself too much. but the flip side of that is, it seems like it's saying, oh, you think you're so important, like, by leaving, like, this damaging quality of you leaving and centering yourself in that way, but it's in this at the same time extremely important that you stay. Like, it feels like it's cautioning mm-hmm. against...
Yes, no, this is very important for two reasons, because then when you read on in the passage, right, you have the next line of this little mini brayta, v'lo od ela shegorim lishchina shetistalek miYisrael. You actually then cause God to leave Israel. Right, so this is confusing, because in this line it does seem like you have the agency to make God leave. But here that's more of a punishment. Right? So I guess my question behind this is a little bit like, to what extent do we think tefillah is meaningful, that there's something real happening when we're engaged in prayer, which is represented here by the very concrete, like, is God's presence there when you pray? And I actually think it's very confusing what this text is saying. Because on the one hand, it's kind of cautioning against you thinking that God's presence comes or leaves based on your own tefillah. But on the other hand, it seems like it's saying, well, if your friend there is still davening, then God's presence is still there, which implies that God's presence is kind of dependent on the fact of somebody davening. It's like, well, yeah, as long as your friend is there and they're davening, then God's presence is there. But if you don't realize that, or you dishonor the fact that the Shekhinah is still there, then actually what will happen is the Shekhinah will leave. In some ways, it seems like, right, God's presence is not about you. You have to realize God's presence is not about you. But in other ways, the question of the sort of fragility of the possibility that God's presence goes beyond you and your relationship with God can vanish in an instant if you don't realize, or if you aren't attentive to the fact that God's presence is there, right? So, right, in some ways, at the end of the day, it seems like God's presence during tefillah is sort of constructed by our attentiveness to the possibility that God's presence might be there. That's what I want to put out this text sort of does. Yeah.
That brings up a question for me, which is, if you, like, are really, like if you're really not feeling it and you really, like, are having a hard time understanding that God could be there for someone else, like, how do you move yourself to create the space for somebody else to be in the presence of the Shekhinah, even if you really, just, like, don't believe it and don't feel it? I think that's like something that makes it really hard for, like, everyone in the community sometimes, like, to make space for both of those ways of feeling.
Yes, and maybe this adds to it. Like, I don't know if this passage of Talmud is dependent on, like, A, you really did feel the Shekhinah was there when you were davening. Because in some ways, I think what you could understand this little Gemara to be doing is saying, like, you must have not really felt God's presence there if you were ready to walk out when somebody else was still davening. Because if you had any sense of the possibility for something meaningful happening in tefillah, in your own tefillah even, then you would never just walk out when somebody else was in the middle of it. So it's almost like it's just the fact that you could leave shows that you are not sensitive to the possibility of what could be happening in tefillah as a real thing. I don't know if this is dependent on somebody actually feeling something in tefillah, right? What if the friend doesn't really feel God's presence there either? Does that kind of make this a moot point? But I guess that's where I think what's happening here is, like, we're getting some language around the delicacy of, or delicateness, that's the right word, the delicateness of, like, could there be something, could we imagine that there might be something real happening in tefillah? How easy it is to puncture that, and how hard it is to kind of cultivate that sense. Yeah.
Is there, like, a possibility here that the presence of Shekhinah is, like, dependent on there being two people? Like, I'm wondering if it's less a question of like whether X person or Y person like feels the presence in their davening, or whether any one of them has control over the presence, or rather the fact of their separating is like the thing that causes it to go, and it's not so much like that one person, like it was there for one person and that person can't dislodge it but then can by leaving, and whether it's like about
right.
them.
Right. Well, right. So that's why I think it's so tricky. It's like that first part of the proof text from Iyov, right? Halama anchate zev aris, at least this is the way that Rashi's reading it. Like, you think God leaves just because of you, but that implies that God doesn't leave just because you're done, which makes it not just about two people. There are other passages where we have, like, if two people are speaking Torah with each other, God's presence is there. We have the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. But that's about learning together. I think in theory you could have said that, but I think it's maybe a little bit harder for the proof text to hold that.
Though it could be something like the Hava Amina, your initial thought is that you think, and this is picking up on the difference between the two parts of the verse, Alaman Chate Azev Eretz, and then Bayet Tak Tzurmim Komo, where that first part is passive and the second part is active.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You might have some
yes.
initial thought that the only thing that matters is whether you're praying, and sort of ipso facto, when you're not praying, God is not there. And that's just wrong. That's what the first part is teaching you. That's wrong. And something more like, actually, the presence, your presence there is what matters. That's what creates the presence of God. But when you leave, there's a rupture. There's an active rupture that you have done sort of almost in some kind of analogous way to God. You're kind of like in a parallel plane doing that which God is doing. You are actively rupturing that presence by leaving. In the way that you leave, God is now leaving.
Yeah, and it's not just like God is temporarily leaving. It sounds like that last part, and I agree with you, the shift from the passive to the active in the verse in Job is I think partly what supports the proof text, where it's like, first part is what you thought, the erroneous thought in your mind, and then the actual conclusion. Now God will never be around. But you thought that God's presence was totally tied to, are you praying to God or not? If you think that, you will never be able to access God again. There is something that's much more important and powerful about your presence to the possibility that God might still be there. That's more important than you actually being engaged in tefillah. We could spend more time on this. Obviously, there's like the beautiful second part of if you do wait, you get all these great rewards. The proof text there, I think, is possibly even more difficult. I don't know. Equally difficult. It, again, doesn't mention prayer at all. Maybe through this language of luhikshav tala mitzvotai, if you had listened to my commandments, right, that language of listening. Here Rashi says hikshavta is like lehamtin, to wait, to be attentive, to linger. That listening is like lingering. So maybe that's what we're talking about. Here, Rashi on the mitzvotai says is to be gomel chesed, which seems to be to do the interpersonal act of kindness, of waiting for the other person. Right? That's what's going to give you a bracha. So I think some of what's happening here is like, take a step back from whatever totally self-centered mindset you might be in your tefillah. Like, if you just had a whole tefillah with God, poured out your heart, asked for something, and then you're able to just turn your back and abandon another person and make them be alone, then something is broken. That is not what tefillah should lead you to. You've missed the point. And instead, right, tefillah has to sort of be intertwined with showing up for other people. And I think there is actually a very technical reception history of this halachically. In Tosafot, it's like maybe in rural communities where actually it was bad to leave somebody alone, you had to be careful about this. But nowadays, says a later Tosafist, when there's much more people in the community around, you don't have to worry about somebody's safety, we don't have to worry about this. There might be something deeper happening theologically in terms of attentiveness towards the possibility that something might be happening in tefillah, that God might be showing up in some way for another person. I think what I'm kind of latching onto here is like thinking through how there can be interpersonal dimensions, right? How we have to show up for each other to create the possibility for having a sense that God could be there when we're davening, right? That's not automatic. Actually, super subtle things, like walking out of a space when you're done the Amida, could totally ruin the possibility for having a sense that God is there. What does that mean? It's like, just think about all sorts of details and subtleties and how you relate to a space where people might be trying to daven, right? What do you have to do? It can require a lot of deliberation and kind of proactive attention to make it possible to have an experience of God for you or for somebody else in a particular space.
When, Francis, you were talking about two people, it's not clear they were, like, going together, going to somewhere to pray, it made me notice that it doesn't say, like, shnei chavirim, like, two friends or two fellows went in to enter. It says shnei chavirim, two people who went in to pray. And then afterwards, after they prayed, and he didn't wait for his friend. So it's not clear that they were, like, fellows walking in. But then clearly after having prayed together, I think they're supposed to be fellows now at this point. You're not supposed to.
That's very beautiful.
It already brings you together in that way. When you're on the same team, I think you're the choice. When you're on the same team at this point, even if you weren't when you walked in.
It's very beautiful to read a sort of journey and arc into that language. Yeah, I'm not sure if there's another way. I guess it could be ha'acher, if it didn't want to emphasize that. So, yes, that's very beautiful.
Kind of on that note, but maybe thinking of, like, on the other side of that, thinking, like, my initial reaction to, like, the person who's still davening, whose friend or acquaintance or person they walked into davening left them, and now causes that, now the Shekhinah's not even there, meaning, like, what am I still davening for? The Shekhinah is not even here anymore. It feels like my initial reaction feels like, well, that's not fair to me if I'm still davening. I didn't control this person walking out. But then I wonder if there's some element of, like, an indictment also on me, let's say, for, like, not explicitly being in communication with this not friend that I was walking in with, clarifying what our intentions were here. Like, I don't know if there's some element of, I also, even though I'm still trying to daven and it's the other person who walked out, I also had some part in the Shekhinah leaving. I don't know, because otherwise it feels like,
not fair.
Why do I have to suffer for that? But it feels like maybe there is some sort of inherent indictment on myself too for, like, not creating the space where this person also knows that, like, what we're creating is something together and intentional and in community, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, great. So if I was to put this in just the most mundane terms, it's like, yes, we can ruin each other's davening without each other's permission. Meaning it's like it's so subtle. It's so fragile. The possibility for, like, actually having some sense of feeling like tefillah could be real, like Hashem could be there. That is such a fragile thing. And we are able to ruin that for each other very easily. And I think partly what this little piece of Talmud does is sort of, A, makes us aware of that, and B, sort of invites us into imagining what it means to do the himtinla, right? Just trying to make it possible to access some sense of Hashem's presence in our tefillah. Okay, we're going to move to part two here, which we won't spend quite as much time on, but essentially this is, if part one is like, interpersonally, how might we need to show up for each other in order to reinforce this possibility of accessing God's presence? Part two here is like, well, maybe God has to do something too, okay? So this is, and this is from Yehuda Amichai's book of poetry, Sagor Patuach, Open, Closed, Open, which is kind of a meditation on tefillah and bringing tefillah into all sorts of doubts of modernity, post-Holocaust theology, and skepticism, some people might say atheism, but kind of weaving that into a very vibrant and playful, somewhat irreverent, but I think ultimately kind of eyes wide open re-engagement with Twila. We can talk about this much more. I don't expect you to love Yehuda Amichai, but I think that this poem is provocative. Okay, so we'll I'll read this and we'll close with some discussion of it. Gam l'tfilat yachid tzrichim shnayim. So even for individual prayer, there always has to be two. There's always two players. Tamid echad shemit no'eh, bashini shelo na, hu ha'elohim. There's always one who moves. Then there's the other one who doesn't move, that's God. It's sort of here overturns of the unmoved mover, the Maimonidean God. Aval, kesha'avi hitpalel hu amad bimkomo. Zakuf uvolinoa vihriach et Elohim lanoa kamo suf ulihit palel el avi. But when my father prayed, says Yehuda Amichai, he just stood still. He was bent over and without moving at all. And he forced God to move like a reed and to pray to my father. I sort of bring this to you to close just because I think there's a lot happening here. And essentially, right, that question of the power of prayer when we are not feeling it, right? Sometimes what we need is other people around us to reinforce things. And sometimes we might just sort of linger in feeling stuck, not actually able to do anything. And yet here, even that stuckness is not the end of our relationship. So I'd love you to go back to your chavruta just for 5 minutes and ask, what do you make of this second half of this poem, right, where the father is taking the posture of God, so to speak, using Yehuda Amichai's language. The father is standing still, making God, ki'ilu, daven to him.
It kind of lays out a standard, which is that you, as the one praying, is the one who's moving, and God is the one who's not moving. And that, like, he lays out this alternative to the standard, which is that his father is still, and that kind of forces God to move, which we took in, I guess, two different directions. The first one being that if you don't have what it takes to put into prayer what the standard generally expects, like, God will do the moving so that your prayer is, like, not moot. Your prayer can still be affected even if you're not as committed or as able to perform, like, the standard. And then, like, the alternative is that perhaps, like, to be still is actually a further, like, leveling up of prayer, and that you've reached this place where God is moving to you, and it's actually an even, like, greater form of prayer. And Alicia made the connection to, like, the Sea of Reeds with, like, kind of that being the greatest miracle that could happen, that, like, it actually represents an even higher form of prayer.
Yeah.
Something that we talked about is if you're always the one that's moving, then sometimes your relationship can feel a little bit, like, one-sided. And that can be a little bit discouraging. And sometimes it's nice to be the one who's still and feel that God is coming to you and that God is there for you when you got to be. And also, she kind of, like, reminded me of the thing that we said, like, at the very, very beginning of the evening, of, like, the difference between, like, reading the words in the Siddur and having to feel it come from your heart. And I think that, like, having to feel it come, reading from the Siddur is like you're the one moving, like you're going, you're opening the Siddur, you're reading the words. But when God is the one that's forced to move, it's like God is coming and moving you to pray, and like that's when it really comes from your heart. And it's like God is coming to you and inspiring you to do it, and both can be meaningful and important.
Great, thank you. Yeah, last comment.
We have a little bit of a different route. We were talking about how this is a really natural stance to take when you're going through or trying to process or understand the very challenging and painful things that happen in life. in terms of,
like, I don't know, like, having a difficult relationship with God at points, and by virtue of that, having a really challenging relationship with prayer, and sometimes even having to do some deconstruction and reconstruction of one's relationship with prayer in order to have that connection and have that conversation, so to speak. Because it can be really hard to have that conversation when you're trying to understand, you know, some of the very challenging things that happen in life.
Great. Okay, thank you. Right. It's kind of fascinating that he sort of lays out, well, this is what tefillah is. There's the one who prays, they move. That's sort of definitional in part one. And then it's kind of complicated. He says the Father's showing up to pray, and yet he's not doing the thing that seems to be what praying is, and has to totally kind of subvert that paradigm. So I think the way I want to close out here is I think this Yehuda Amichai poem takes us to a place of, if for some reason you don't have the wherewithal to do what you think prayer is supposed to be, and yet there's still this showing up, even if it's in a posture that would seem to undermine what you think tefillah is supposed to be, right? Then it's like, okay, then like maybe what needs to happen, if you can't pray to God in the way that you think praying to God is supposed to happen, but you show up anyway, then maybe you'll discover something new about God's capacity. And it will sort of catalyze that. So I hope sort of putting these two things together, we can end with a sense of, like, what if I'm not feeling this power? Do I have to feel the power of tefillah myself all the time? And if I don't, is tefillah kind of meaningless? I think we have two ways to respond to that question, right? One, no, it's not just about you. There's some really important role for others to play in reinforcing and creating the possibility for anyone to have some kind of access to a sense of the divine. And we can all know that we could play a role for each other that is some kind of reinforcing role, even if that's not at all explicit. It's not like we are now going to have a conversation about God, although this week we probably will. Just in the subtlety of how we can convey our sense of believing in, imagining the possibility that another person could have a connection with God, right? That can help create the possibility for everyone, including ourselves. And two, right, if we're just stuck, if we've kind of reached the limits of thinking that we know how to access some relationship to a God who we can pray to, then maybe if we still decide we're going to show up anyway, we can expect from God that God will kind of teach us and manifest for us what it can look like to be in this relationship in a new way.